Well, welcome everyone to the fourth and final series of this these talks, seminars. I'm going to show you some pictures because it's about religion and art, so I thought I'd better show you some pictures, as it doesn't make much sense without that. So I'm going to partly read my text and partly talk and live. Now, about 7 months after his wife died, John Constable, the romantic painter, wrote to his friend, whose name was John Fisher, in July 1829. He quotes, "The whole object and difficulty of the art, and indeed of all the fine arts, is to unite imagination with nature." And that interests me, that uniting imagination with nature as a kind of expressing a romantic ideal. And it seemed to me that that's what the great sort of romantic landscape painters sought to achieve in the early 19th century. The understanding of art as a unity of imagination and nature, and that points to an understanding of art as a creative force that somewhat akin to the idea of a creator himself, in a sense, in a Christian theological context. Now today I wish to argue that the distinctive characteristic of religious art has been its cosmological orientation, and to show how some contemporary art seeks to re-establish the cosmological link which was broken with the development of secularism. So that's what I'm going to argue roughly. So there's a close proximity between religion and art, and both show us something about the world, and both unleash the imagination, and both give concrete expression to intellectual and emotional vision. So, roughly, that's the argument, that there's religion and art are closely connected in terms of cosmology, that religious art expresses a cosmology in the pre-modern world. That gets lost with modernity, and art becomes kind of secularized. But in kind of post-modernity, I suppose, there's an orientation towards religion again within art, and an attempt to reconnect or re-establish that cosmological orientation. Now, the idea of art as a general category that included literature and music, as well as painting, only began to emerge 50 years before Constable's letter to his friend, influenced by the concept of Kunst in German Romanticism. Goethe's friend Carl Philipp Moritz wrote a book on the plastic imitation of the beautiful, Über die Bildende Nachahmung des Schönen, which was precisely about the representation of nature through the imagination and the artist's ability to recreate as being parallel to the creativity of the, quote, the great totality of nature itself. And while Constable was far too down to earth to adopt such pantheistic views, the understanding of art as the imaginative recreation of nature became pervasive and defining. The artist mediated the vastness of nature, and yet contained that vastness within a canvas. Mediated nature through culture. Indeed, art became a quasi-religious activity, something which has arguably continued to the present day, and the artist almost akin to a priest. Although this was not the language that Constable would have recognised, we might say that the artist shows us something that the world that would otherwise remain hidden, and that only comes into view indirectly through the imagination. While the nature and definition of art has changed, the insight that art unites imagination with nature is still pertinent. Art shows us something about the world that only comes into view indirectly, and which could be said in no other way, and is inseparable from the telling. So, Constable has this idea of art and imagination. He articulates that idea, but it's not just Constable, it's deeply resonant in the whole Romantic movement, really. And this is the Romantic ideal. And the artist shows us something that would otherwise remain hidden, and shows us indirectly, and the message is inseparable from the medium. Now, there are many definitions of art, from aesthetic theorists of the 19th century, such as John Ruskin, echoing Constable, who saw art as the articulation of the truth of nature, to postmodern theorists such as Clement Greenberg, for whom modernist art is purely reflexive, concerned with the critiquing of art itself. And also Levinson, who I'll be talking about in a minute. Modernist art, particularly initiated by that supreme smasher of icons, Marcel Duchamp, spurned a tradition of art as critique, art as critique, which challenged orthodox social and religious values through to the present. The meaning and social function of art changes over the centuries, and some philosophers of art, notably Gerald Levinson, have argued for the irreducible historicity of the concept of art. He writes, whether something is art now depends, and inevitably, on what has been art in the past. I claim, in other words, that the concept, the concrete history of art, is logically implicated in the way the concept of art operates. On this view, art is an artifact that is intended to be art, as some prior artifact was so intended. Now, arguably, if we were looking at art in terms of modernity, pre-modernity, modernity, and post-modernity, in a way, the Charles Taylor argues that the concept of the self in pre-modernity is what he calls porous, so that there's the boundaries between self and world are porous. So, in such a world, the cosmos and the person are integrated together, and what is outside the body, if you like, in the world, comes into the self. So the forces that were subjected to astrology, supernatural forces, possession by demons, and visitations by angels, and all this kind of thing, is normal or natural in the notion of the core self. And that gets lost with modernity, if we've looked at in past weeks. And that there are some developments in art reflect a nostalgia, an attempt to re-sacralize art, or an attempt to help us live within a cosmos of a sacred canopy. So there's a retrieval of a magical cosmology, which is also arguably a retrieval of the porous self. Now, romantic art, the whole object and difficulty of the art, and indeed of all the fine arts, is to unite the imagination with nature. That's again the Portugal quote. And romantic art then seeks to re-establish a cosmological link. Arguably that gets lost about the 17th century, but romantic art has a certain nostalgia or a longing for that link, for that porous self, which is broken with the development of what Taylor calls the buffet self with the self of modernity, where the link between self and cosmos is severed, and we become a disembodied ego, a disembodied mind that has judgment and interacts causally with a mechanistic material universe that we ourselves are different from. That now that's a rupture with the old view, with the old ego, the cosmological. And arguably some romantic art begins to kind of have a longing for the... Well, as Schleiermacher talks about religion as longing for the infinite, so it's a classical definition of romanticism, longing for the infinite. And that is arguably an attempt to reconnect with this cosmological view that is lost. The artist then mediates nature and is contains it within the canvas. So I think that's quite important, that the artist contains nature within the canvas. And the artist is arguably akin to a priest. And the artist shows us something that one otherwise remains obscure. So these are Constable's canvases, which we take for granted, but they're really quite magnificent if you kind of look at them fresh. I saw some in Washington once, some massive canvases of Constable in the exhibition, but also classic. But this is Dedham, no, it's not Dedham Hall. You remember?
Something like
Flatford.
Oh, it could be that, yeah. And that's Dedham Church from somewhere in the valley. But these contained, the nature contained and controlled, if you like. Now, modernist art, in contrast to that,
the previous one, Rembrandt?
No, it was Constable, 19th century Constable, romantic landscape painter. The rival of Turner, really. Now, modernism, according to Peter Gay, in a book a couple of years ago, says that modernist art is characterised by the lure of heresy and return to the self. He must be pretty old now, Peter Gay, but he's still producing these interesting books. And modernist art is art as critique, if you like. And the beginning of modernist art is arguably, of the plastic arts, is really arguably Duchamp, who is what Gay calls a smasher of icons. And this is an example of art as critique of society, but also critique of itself. And this famous Duchamp's Fountain in 1917. So the intentionality of art is defined by its historical location and its implicit reference back to the past. Duchamp would make no sense unless seen in the context of artistic formalism and the romantic expressivism against which he was reacting. And it's surely not coincidental that Duchamp presented his urinal in 1917, which was the bloodiest year of the First World War. Another one, Serrano, which caused some controversy in 1987. Serrano's Peace Christ, which is a crucifix in the artist's urine. Now, there's a certain beauty to this image, but it caused a lot of controversy and a lot of objections from the church when it was exhibited.
And even more controversial was Christophe's Virgin Mary, 1999,
which was made with the elephant dung. Now, I mean, that was a traditional material used in African art. So it's a kind of a Eurocentrism to criticise this on the grounds of that it's defaming the Virgin Mary. I don't think it is really. So anyway, he's African, yeah. And lastly, Tracy Emin's famous bed. Again, example of art seen in a context, being possible to recreate this now, she says. Well, I think she does still have exhibitions, but the idea of art as critique, art as critique of what went before. Now, Levinson's theory of art, he talks about the irreducibility of the irreducible historicality of art. And art is an artifact intended to be art. So Tracy Emin's bed is art because it's intended to be art. And the intentionality of the art is defined by its historical location. The sublime is no longer sufficient to speak about. It's no longer sufficient to speak about in terms of the sublime, because we have to see it in historical context. And if art is intended to evoke emotion, disgust might count as one of the emotions that art evokes. Yeah, his art seems to have to evoke the emotion.
But the sublime is not forgotten in modern art, and Lyotard refers to Malevich's white paintings as expressing the sublime, considered a series of black paintings.
There was an exhibition of Malevich in London about 3 years ago. And they're actually very impressive when you see them in the flesh, isn't it? So artwork is artifacts intentionally produced. An artwork is an artifact that is intentionally produced that communicates. That's Levinas and that's others as well. So art is a communicative act, as Jacobson thought the structuralist thought as well. And art is characterized by addressivity. It's intended to address an audience. It's an expression of authorial intention, that's controversial, and also what is outside of that. I'll put a question mark on that. And it's also mimetic, a mimetic of nature as it quotes the law, a mimetic of emotion, as in Jackson Pollock's canvases. I don't have a picture of Pollock, but he's the one that splashed paint on canvases, the pockets of painter. Again, if you look at those in a book and you think they're okay, but then you go and see them, and I saw it, I had the privilege of seeing Pollock in London about 5-6 years ago, and that was it was overwhelming. It was these canvases were so sort of had a depth to them, and a cosmic depth to them, which was stunning.
Which doesn't come across, I don't think, didn't come across to me anyway, in their representations and books. So there's a sense of outside of these characteristics, the sublime is exceeding the beautiful.
So if art has these characteristics, addressivity, expression of authorial intention, possibly, and also it's mimetic in some sense, there's also perhaps a fourth characteristic that it points to something sublime, or something that exceeds the beautiful. Now, by way of a contrast with that modernist kind of art we've looked at, we've got cosmological art. Now, this quality of mimesis is precisely why Plato rejected art, particularly painting. Art was an imitation of the world, which itself is a reflection of a higher, pure form. Now, in the Republic, Socrates reasons with Glaucon that there are three kinds of bed. One created by a god, one created by a carpenter, and one created by a painter. We might add a fourth, one created by J.C. Ewing. But the god's bed represents the true nature of being of the carpenter's bed that he makes. So you've got the god's bed, which is the pure bed, the idea of the bed, if you like, and then the carpenter makes a real bed, which reflects the pure bed of the god. And the god's bed represents the true nature or being of the carpenter's bed. Whereas the painter's bed is an imitation of the carpenter's bed. And the painter paints a picture, so the painter imitates the carpenter's bed, which is itself an imitation of the pure bed. And I guess Tracy Emin's is an imitation of the... No, what is Tracy Emin's bed? That's closer to the carpenter's bed than the painter's bed. But the painter imitates what others have made, and so it's three times removed from the ideal form. So thus art, for Plato, is an imitation of an imitation. It takes us away from the real, rather than bringing us into it. So painting is essentially deceptive. But luckily, Plato's dim view of art did not dominate even the classical world. Although his idea of the form of truth, beauty and goodness did come to have a central place in Western metaphysics, and indeed art and aesthetics. Rather than a moving away from the real, from truth, beauty and goodness, art comes to be seen as a representation of the real, an attempt to achieve and participate in beauty, truth and goodness. Art comes to be not a pale reflection of a reflection, but a participation in the real and a manifestation of it. Thus in the early church, particularly Eastern Orthodox Church, we have the development of the idea of God as infinite beauty and the purpose of worship as participation in the beauty of God. Philosophia, the love of wisdom, accompanied by philokalia, the love of beauty,
which is a longing for God, often humans are in affliction. Thus Gregory of Nyssa says that human being manifests divine beauty, and Gregory Nazianzus makes the point that we approach God not by comprehension, because God is infinite magnitude, but by participation. And the idea of participation is a strong feature of the course itself.
And we see this idea of participation in many of the sacred architecture. We see the same thing in Hindu and Buddhist and the Jain art of the early medieval period. So the wonderful temples at Tanjore, here at Tanjore, and the stupas at Sanchi bear witness to a revelatory aesthetic in which the cosmos, people with divine beings, is represented in stone. The icon at the centre of the temple, protected by the ferocious royal guardians, embodies the deity in concrete form. So the god has a body in the sound form of the mantra and in the spatial form of the stone icon. The participation is a key to understanding pre-modern religious art. Through the icon, the worshipper comes to participate in the divine and to share the being with God. The intensity of meaning is linked to the intensity of the encounter. Many of the medieval theologians saw the world as a manifestation of God's ineffable beauty and conceptualized the universe, in the words of Umberto Eco, as, quote, filled with light and optimism. One of the first to understand the universe in this way was the 5th or 6th century mystical theologian Denis the Pseudo-Areopagite, who writes, "But the super-essential beautiful is called beauty because of the beauty communicated by it to all beautiful things in accordance with their nature. It calls all things to itself, whence it also names beauty, and it gathers together all in itself. From this beautiful, all things have their being." Now, Denis may have directly influenced the Gothic architecture, as Pilevsky argues in that book on Suger, the architect. So again, you've got this kind of technological dimension. Yeah, Denis, he was Greek, yeah. He was a Syriac monk. Yeah, 5th century Syriac monk. Wrote the divine names and the mystical theology.
I think he's responsible for coining the term mystical theology. Now, the poorer stuff is also theorized by theologians. Florensky is an example of theorizing cosmological art. And he regarded the saint as one who has achieved a vision of the Trinity, and the heavenly light shines on one who has achieved theosis, that's union with God, and art reflects this heavenly light. So art is divine in his view, it's a reflection of the heavenly light. And he makes a distinction between the art of ascent, which is secular art, like Plato, he rejects that, which is mere representation, an art of descent, which is symbolism, which is cosmological art. And that's art that allows you access to the divine because it expresses the beauty of God. And my being is transformed through contact with transcendent power, and such power is expressed through the artwork. So the icon, if you like, parallels the human icon of the saint. The saint is a living icon, a walking icon, and the plastic icon reflects, parallels that. The purpose of life is to establish ourselves in God, who is our true home.
And this is the kind of poor self. I thought I had some icons. No, I didn't. I must be on a different
flower. Anyway, theorizing a Shaiva theorist of art is also a Kashmiri Brahmin called Abhinavagupta. He wrote a commentary on a book called The Life of Suggestion. And through art, basic human emotions are transformed into aesthetic emotions, such as bravery and human emotions transformed into heroism, anger is transformed into fury, desire is transformed into the erotic, laughter to comedy, and grief is transformed into compassion. And these aesthetic emotions express and give access to transcendent consciousness. Again, of course, view of the self and the boundaries of the self are variable. Now, I do think I had some creatures of icons. Coming into the contemporary world, you get an attempt to re-spiritualize art. Kandinsky was an early 20th century artist who wanted to do this, and he wrote a book called on the Spiritual in Art, and which is a historical search for abstract art. And he's interested in form and harmony, and form harmony must rest on a corresponding vibration in the human soul. So he thought there was a vibration in the soul which was reflected in art. So this is not really cosmological art, arguably, participatory in the sense that we've just spoken about, but it does express an inner world over against materialism for Kandinsky. It was one of Kandinsky's canvases. He was influenced by theosophy as well as many of them were, including Mondrian. Now coming up to
I wanted to say a bit more about Kandinsky.
Art for Kandinsky, before I get on to Nietzsche. Art for Kandinsky is about expression, the expression of inner meaning, and the harmony of form that corresponds to something within human subjectivity. So every artist, Kandinsky writes, is a creator for something within that needs expression. He is, quote, a child of his age who expresses the spirit of his age and is a servant to art. And Kandinsky thought that there's a strong link between music and art, and even saw his canvases as representations of music. Simple forms he described as melodic, while complex forms as symphonic, and we can read the history of art through this lens. Thus, Cézanne is melodic for Kandinsky, and Russian icons in Japanese art, along with the old German masters, are symphonic, like the symphonies of Mozart and Beethoven. Although his treatise is clearly modernist, there are parallels in the religious art we've looked at previously. While not participatory in the cosmic sense that we have seen, it's nevertheless expressive of an inner world that, to Kandinsky's view, is to be distinguished from an outer materialism of his age. And there are parallels with Florensky, and indeed he was schooled within the Russian tradition, but his work marks a new direction, a spirituality which is spontaneously inward, as set against any standards of tradition and conformity. Kandinsky's spirituality is very modern and very non-traditional, seeing a new vision in the new world. Now, contemporary art is marked by its variety, and there is clearly a tradition of art in the spirit of Kandinsky that has severed the link with formal religion. Influenced both directly and indirectly by Freud, this new kind of art emphasizes catharsis, purification through the expression of emotion and instinct. And that purification of emotion and instinct through its expression. And much performance art is like this, and can involve bloodletting and body sculpting. And in Germany, Hermann Nitsch, Das Orgien Mysterien Theater, the Orgy Mystery Theater, offers a 6-day performance, which is an aesthetic ritual with no other pretext than its performance and the expression of what Nietzsche calls joyful lust and the building up of an emotional energy that erupts in a climax to foster intensive sensory sensations, quote, that lead later to an orgiastic sadomasochistic acting out, including the killing and disemboweling of animals and the experiencing of raw flesh. This is a quote from Nietzsche. Raw flesh, damp bowels, still at body temperature, blooded feces, blood warmed from the slaughter, all of which produces, quote, a Dionysic dismemberment situation. and an eruption of mystical aggression and cruelty. End quote. Yes, interestingly, Nietzsche associates all of this with Holderlin's understanding of the tragic and the idea that man's inner core becomes one with the power of nature in rage. A catharsis or frenzied abreaction releases dammed up energy and achieves a tranquility and sense of union being spread across life. So this heady mixture of psychoanalysis and German romanticism is spiritual art a long way from Kandinsky's vision, Kandinsky's canvases, as an expression of inwardness. Nietzsche's dismemberment situation seems particularly European, articulating a spirituality with its roots in German romanticism and German and European paganism. It is consciously anti-Christian in its embrace of sacrifice, its pantheism, its appeal to Dionysius, and in looking back to Greek tragedy. While we can see a connection between Nietzsche and his orgy mystery theatre, it seems to derive much of its inspiration from Nietzsche indeed. And here we have art not for its own sake, but as a tool for cleansing purification and a liberation of the self from its own repression. Perhaps a uniquely German form of contemporary art that sacrifices Apollonian rationality to Dionysian catharsis. At this point I want to show you reduce that a bit. I didn't know how to incorporate this into my own text. Sorry, this mouse is.
I think you can Google it, the title of the painting.
Right.
And click on the images in Google search.
So if I do that,
it will come up. If you go to the browser.
Google it. How do I do that then?
You want me to do it?
Go ahead. I think the problem
really
is mouse, I think.
It.
If you really want to see it. Oh, yeah, yes, perhaps people should shut their eyes if you don't mind. If we click on Bloodlines, because I've saved it on this stick. But
the computer doesn't have a program to open it.
Ah.
It's just slow, it'll open in a second.
Oh, okay.
The page. You can sit down.
No, you sit down here and you can. Nietzsche had an exhibition in the States in 2011, and this is a.
Oh.
Do you know Nietzsche's?
I've seen some. Yeah.
This is an. It's
slow. Internet is just slow, but we are there. Okay.
Katie Holmes has a. These PCs seem terribly slow to me now. I don't know if they're going to stand on the slopes.
Like, by the time they open the page, you can actually reach the museum. Okay. What happened now? Default browser? No.
We need new computers, don't we, really, etc. Oh, never mind, it's not going to happen, is it?
It's not mouse, it's because the computer is slow. Nor does mouse. Okay.
There was a stupid computer.
Okay. So, bloodlines.
Niche, if you just type in niche, N-I-T-C.
N-I-T-C-H. Yeah. But.
Oh, we'll have to give. I think we might have to give up. Never mind.
Fast strike. Okay. N-I-T-C-H. C-H. There was S, I think. N-I-T-S-H-C-H.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, I'll just
try
with it.
No. We are almost there. N-I-T-S-C-H.
Yeah.
Bloodlines. Bloodlines.
Which search, I suppose, do we do that? Speed up.
We request.
Okay,
which one is this? Images.
No, it's a specific one. It's a YouTube one. Bloodlines. Painting is the second one.
The images will give us the.
See, that's the second one.
It's the second link.
Second link.
Okay.
The YouTube link.
But that's the video, right?
Yes, video, yeah.
Okay. Okay. How would it play
it's
video
really
when it's not even opening page? I think it, looking at it, picture would be a better idea.
Yeah, it's if we look at the... Yeah, try and click on bloodlines to see if it works.
If mouse can't get there...
Nothing will happen, will it, if the mouse doesn't get there?
Come on. Some mantra might work.
Some mantra might work.
Yeah, halfway. Almost there. Okay.
Needs a little rest.
Yeah.
It's Austrian.
Yeah, he's Austrian. Isn't that annoying? I know, that doesn't work.
No.
Right
there. Okay. Now the bigger fight begins.
It's an interesting. It's only about 4 minutes, but it's an interesting video. 5 minutes.
Okay. Ask me later.
Oh yeah, here we go. Can we get sound?
Maybe.
It's on mute.
It's on mute?
How do we demute it?
I can do it. If the mouse mutes. Fastest pause it.
Press space bar, that'll pause.
Yeah, it's paused. So now the mouse is almost halfway. almost there. Like, it's like playing golf.
Yes.
This mouse is.
One of these might be the sound, mightn't it?
No, the computer sound is mute. I'm just waiting to get there.
Is there a keyboard key to the computer sound?
Yeah, so I was wondering.
Almost there. Come on. I don't know. What happened?
It's amazing.
Okay.
The internet sucks. It's really
no.
Slow on
my
phone.
Go.
It's not muted then.
No, it is muted. I have to go to that icon and click on it.
Unmute. Oh, well done. Whee!
The computer is not that stubborn. Good thing is, by the time we're done the video will actually load.
Oh, yes. Well done.
Mm-hmm. Watch it on the iPhone.
Oh, we can hear it on that. And
No, no, the sound is not a problem now. The problem is the page. We need to get the page down. And then play it. The mouse doesn't work. Once it's down, then we are all set.
That's his music. He composed the music with the Google's network.
That's him.
He looks
quite old.
He looks a very pig. He looks like a Viking.
Oh, no. Need to go here.
Where do we need to go?
Right here. Just one last. Okay.
Mm. Wow. Oh, dear.
What I'm doing here is a new kind of theater. It's
thank you.
A theater that's coming out of the tradition of Hedonism, activism of Fluxus, and performance tradition. And one part of my work is this kind of activity. You see,
we wanted to do something in which we help to establish Nietzsche, this part of Nietzsche's work, on its own. So this is essentially an exhibition of paintings, and sometimes the paintings get overshadowed because obviously the performances are the much more compelling. But we wanted to make a claim. I wanted to, as a curator, I wanted to make a claim for Nietzsche as a painter. Paintings are, in some ways, relics of these larger action and performances. I have a particular interest in the ways in which contemporary art and religion intersect. So these very much their shamanistic quality, the whole claims that are made for these action and for the paintings, in fact, which Nietzsche often refers to as relics. And relics are intermediate objects. You know, they mediate between the ordinary world, the prosaic world of every day, and this redemptive future. So it was very interesting to me that here was an artist who uses what you might call transgressive means. You know, the slaughter of animals, the draping of the end, towards a very utopian almost end, which is to free people from, to use Freudian language, repression, and to give them an experience of catharsis in which they are reborn, and in the process of that rebirth, can freshly experience themselves in the world in a new light, one which is beautiful and tender and suffused with meaning and significance. So to me, that was kind of interesting that, there's this kind of transgressive, one might say, or grim side to the proceedings. A lot of taboos are broken. A lot of instinctual energies are released. But the project itself is a very utopian one. And also, I love the idea that the paintings were relics. And it's interesting to me because blood relics really are amongst the most important relics in Europe, in Christian churches. And two in particular came to my mind. One is the Shroud of Turin, and the other is called the Sudarium, the sweat cloth, the cloth with which St. Veronica wiped Jesus' face on the road to Calvary. And so many centuries of devotion and piety and sentiment have covered up the sort of the real bloodiness of those occasions. And I think, in some sense, these paintings sort of restore, once again, thinking of them as relics, the paintings restore us to the sort of bloody truth rather than the accretion of sentiment and piety that's accrued over the centuries.
In my theater, everything happens in reality. There's no actor who plays King Lear or working with colors, with paint, with blood, with meat, with intestines. This is very important that he feel himself very intensive, that he wake up, that he is not in a lukewarm existence. I try to show intensity, and all the audience shall be learn to feel our senses very, very intensive.
Obviously, yes, it will always be controversial, and there will always be some people for whom the larger utopian project is won't be accessible to them because they won't be able to get past the means by which these things come about. When Nietzsche began to conceive of these performances, these akshonen, this was during a time when a similar movement was happening in America. You know, there were happenings. There were people like Alan Capra, people like Jim Dine, even the Fluxus group, Yoko Ono. You know, we're doing similar kinds of happenings, but they had more of a prankster quality. They weren't a nihilistic practice, whereas in Europe it tended to be much more serious and much more bloody. And it made me wonder if, particularly in Germany and Austria, people still weren't processing, still didn't need to have a means of catharsis to process their role or roles in the war. And I think whether that's true or not, it struck me as a way of making more credible the claims for the cathartic nature of the violence that's involved in making these, in doing these. There was, you know, the Germans and the Viennese have a different relationship to the possibility of catharsis precisely because of they're still busy processing their roles.
Let's just stop doing it.
Perhaps they just enjoy doing it.
So you got the measure of them.
It'd be interesting to know what the effect of participating in this ritual or actions
yes,
is
indeed.
On the participants, such
yep.
as a few years down the line.
Yep. It is. Oh, I see. On the center.
And there's a sort of very primitive draft, not up to the surface, and then down to the
sure.
I think only out of Austria.
Yeah.
It's significant.
Here we are again, so. If I press that, do you think it'll come big?
Down, D3.
Oh, yeah, those three icons, I can
see. The one on the right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the right?
Yeah. And let's try to. This mouse won't go.
I think it's also
should have
just
clicked.
If you click now. No? Move it in?
It's frozen.
Mm. That's annoying. It's nearly there.
Yeah, this computer, how old is it?
I don't know.
Oh, no.
Too much stuff on it.
It's frustrating, isn't it? Anyway, let's see if we can... Is that what it's doing? Isn't it? It's waiting to catch up with itself. Is it? Oh. Hey. Right. So that's Hermann Nietzsche. There we are.
Another one, Anna Mendita, whizzed through these, 48 to 80, 59 to 85. She says, I want my images to have power, to be magic. I decided that for the images to have magic qualities, I had to work directly with nature. I had to go to the source of life, to Mother Earth. And her work is an attempt to reconnect with the universe and to link her female body to the Earth, the union of imagination with nature. And she's famous for her chicken piece, I won't show that, where she holds a decapitated chicken in front of her and blood pours everywhere. And another one that my wife Amy introduced me to, Bill Viola, who is he's a very interesting video artist whose work is has a certain beauty to it. I do have a video of him, but we haven't got time to see it. And Narsi Gormley, I leave a question mark over him, but there are lots of whether he is a sort of re-spiritualising of art. But there are others, Goldsworthy and Richard Long, who are interested in the environment and as a kind of interest in the sacred quality of nature. So in all of these, this re-spiritualization of art, if you like, there's a rejection of a mechanized machine-like material universe devoid of spirituality with sexualization. There's also a rejection of traditional religions. And Mendita and Mitch are interested in what might be called an autochthonous spirituality that draws on the ancient past and emphasises land, Mother Earth, nature cycles and the body. And Bill Viola is a more cerebral meditation on stillness, transience and the inevitability of death. He was nearly drowned and his work reflects that drowning experience. And arguably these are what we might call the quest for the poorer self, the expression of the union with the imagination in nature, and perhaps a new romanticism. So, by way of conclusion, you have art has aggressivity, it has expression, it has a mimetic, an imitative quality, but also this extra quality, which is hard to define. And that extra quality is perhaps linked to what John Barker calls conducive properties, in objects of art that elicit the language of satisfaction in communities of reception. And looking at what are these, how do you specify these conducive properties? And that's quite an interesting topic. Now arguably this has relevance for phenomenology. There's a difference between the porous and the buffered self. And the philosophical articulation of the buffer self is the transcendental ego for his soul. And the poorer self hasn't got a philosophical articulation in the contemporary world, arguably, but its contemporary expression is through art rather than through philosophy. So that's it. Well, thanks for your attention, everyone, and thank you for putting up with this bad...